Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is the Wrestling Culture Podcast. It's Dave Musgrave chiming in here, and I believe, Dylan, you were already on the line.
Yes, sir. I'm here.
Can you hear me?
You there?
Can you hear me? Okay? Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Yeah. Was there a second there where you couldn't?
Yeah, there was like a 3 or 4 second dead air, but that's all right.
Yeah, technological wizards here at Wrestling Club.
Rebels against the future, as my friend Kirkpatrick Sale, the biographer of the Luddites, would say.
Well, you know what it is? We do a lot of retro stuff, and today we're talking about Camp Terror, whose heydays was the 70s and 80s. So we really try to get into character and do some method acting and, you know, act like we're from the 70s and 80s and don't know how to log in.
What the hell is this?
Yeah.
Right? That's a good – we should stick with that story. I mean, it's obviously not true, but we should stick with it anyway.
How are you today?
I'm good. It's pretty rainy and crappy outside today, but other than that, pretty good day down here. How about up north?
I think they're good. I was actually watching a TV show the past week or so with my wife called Surface, which is about sea monsters and stuff like that, the environment, ecological terrorism, blah, blah, blah. But anyways, in the last episode, which was actually the last episode of the series because it got canceled in 2005, there was a tsunami hitting South Carolina.
Oh, shit.
And poor Dylan.
I always joke with my mother-in-law about that. She's from New Jersey, and she comes down to visit. She stays in this motel that's out on the beach here. And, you know, she's a real sweet lady, but she's also very prone to worrying about everything, no matter what the likelihood of those things are. So, you know, as we're looking out over the ocean, every time she comes to visit... Yeah, every time she comes to visit, she's looking out of the ocean. No.
Yeah.
It is called Tides. And I every single time she'll be sitting out there, sometimes trying to relax and unwind after a glass of wine, and I'll say, "Man, if we got hit with a tsunami now, we would all be dead." That usually ends the fun for the evening.
You know what? You should take her to the Maritimes in the Bay of Fundy, which has the highest tides in the world sometime, and she'll be convinced the world's ending.
Well, my wife does want to go to the Maritimes now, despite the epidemic of child killing that goes... oh, God, I don't even know the name of that movie. I'm just... Yeah, but...
Dear Zachary. Yeah, everyone, just in case you're wondering, there's a movie about a horrible child welfare case, basically, in Newfoundland, where, you know, the ball gets dropped sometime, and it was basically punted into the stance in this situation.
Yeah, I've heard about that nonstop for a couple weeks. Anyway.
I had a funny story for you that we have a friend whose birthday we went out for on Saturday, and she kind of gets a kick out of the fact that every conversation I have, somehow I can relate it back to wrestling.
So I do the same thing. But
yeah. And sure enough, here we are at a Mexican restaurant. I'm looking through, and I find on the menu, comiones, or whatever it is. I guess it's probably Spanish for shrimp. Comiones el Santo. And I pointed out to Anne, and it's like named for the famous Mexican wrestler, and that's awesome. Too bad I don't eat seafood, or I would get it.
That's pretty great, and I especially because I can actually envision there being a little mini down there in Mexico right now with that actual name.
Yes. Oh, and the other one I mentioned to you too when we were chatting one night online about when we were in Cuba, which I always talk about on our podcast, and we were seeing some guy who had souvenirs, and I heard him say, "El Calibre," and I was like, "A hummingbird." I didn't even hesitate. I hadn't even seen it. But, and then I'm like, and I knew that because that's what Rey Mysterio was called early in his career.
You know, it's funny because
she was kind of.
I'm sure she was found it both amusing and appalling. It's funny because my, I always joke with, you know, my friends and other people I know that the reason I had such a good vocabulary when I was a kid was from watching pro wrestling, which is actually not entirely a joke. You know,
pretty much my entire knowledge of U.S. geography comes from pro wrestling.
See, I mean,
even some Canadian.
See, there you go, because that's actually a good segue, because the person we'll be talking about today, Kim Patera, there are a lot of places Kim Patera worked around the United States that most Canadians may not know exist.
No.
If they were only wrestling
fans,
they know what Tulsa was.
Today, it's episode 9. We're getting up there. Episode 9 that has recorded. We're probably on about 11 or 12 when you count hours put in. But we're talking about Kim Patera and what an awesome guy he is.
Well,
nothing rhymes with Patera, so it's hard to come up with anything too witty.
No, yeah, Kim Patera, I think, is a pretty interesting fella. I got into kind of examining his career, actually, as an outgrowth of a few months back when I became really fascinated with Jerry Blackwell's career, primarily as Blackwell's AWA stuff, but some of that stuff before and after that, St. Louis and other places. And obviously they were a tag team in the AWA, the Sheiks, managed by Adnan Al-Casey. And basically my entire interest in Patera spun off from a big collection of data that I had compiled via other sources, I should say, flat out. James Zordani, who's an awesome results guy, Clawmaster is what he goes by online, Mid-Atlantic Gateway, Gary Will's site for Toronto. I mean, there's some great guys out there that do real work. I just steal it all and look at it. But
it's not plagiarism if you give credit.
But catalysts for me really looking at Patera closely was when I was putting all the Blackwell results together in one place and sort of, you know, editorializing here and there about what the results sort of pointed to, somebody sort of kind of cavalierly dismissed Jerry Blackwell as that big of a star because, you know, well, even Kim Patera had a better career. And I thought, well, Kim Patera had a better career than a lot of people. You know, he's not a necessarily somebody people think of as a first-tier, all-time great wrestler. However, if you actually go back and look at his results in his career, which started in late 1972, and then follow it all the way forward, I think you can make a case that he really was a really far bigger star than he remembered, largely because of the fact that, I was just going to say, he's not
Kelly Kowalski or Buddy.
Yes. Yeah, go ahead.
He's not Kelly Kowalski or Buddy Rogers.
No. No, he's not. But I think that's actually, you know, Patera to me is, he's a unique, I was having a conversation with somebody the other day who was asking me about what I've been, you know, the things I'd looked at and compiled and was kind of, you know, going through with Patera. And he kind of tossed out this name as a point of comparison, and I'm not saying this is even really the best comparison because I think this guy was a better long-term draw at least one place, but he's kind of similar to me in a weird way to Wahoo McDaniel. I mean, obviously their gimmicks are a lot different and they're not exactly the same, but in the sense that they always seem to pop up places and they popped up on top and they were guys who worked with every major star for the era that they were around. When most people think Wahoo, they don't necessarily think of him as an anchor of a promotion. I mean, he definitely was one of the anchors of Mid-Atlantic, but I don't know that many people think of him this way now. I think rightly or wrongly. And I think with Patera, he was certainly never the anchor of a promotion. But he was definitely a guy who headlined.
He wasn't better off, though.
No. I mean, he headlined against everybody. And, I mean, we're going to get into the results, I guess, here a little bit. But he really headlined against everybody of note during his run. And not just like one-offs either. Not like, oh, you have one match against Andre the Giant, so what? I mean, it's not like that. Like, either sustained programs or featured main events in the big buildings all over the country. So, and really in Canada, too, actually.
And
so.
And as a comparison to Wahoo McDaniel, Wahoo McDaniel had more big years than Patera, but I would say Patera's biggest year is bigger than Wahoo's biggest year.
That's probably true. I mean,
I can't think what Wahoo's biggest year is. Like, he had a lot of big years, but it's probably 1 year, some year that he was in the Carolinas, right? But
I'm sure it was.
Whereas you take Patera, not to jump ahead into the results too much, but Patera's 1980 was, it's pretty unbelievable when you look at it.
Yeah, I think so too. I think Patera has, you know, and another thing, in fact, I'll just kind of jump right ahead in this and kind of kick the ball rolling with his results. Like I said, he started in 72. He was very late 72. December of 72 is the first results I can find. It's possible maybe he worked some small spot shows a little bit before that, although I've found no evidence of it.
One thing to interject with, actually,
sure.
Dylan, have you seen the old movie, The Wrestler? The
1970s. Yes, I have.
The,
with Ed Asner?
Yeah. With Ed Asner and Vern Gagne and Billy Robinson are the focal point of it.
Yep, I've seen it.
And Patera makes a little cameo in that, and I think that was pre his career actually starting. I think he was probably training at the point. And they were in the gym and they showed him working out and said, here's a guy who's training to wrestle, and it was Ken Patera, and they said he was an Olympian, so... Anyway.
That's pretty crazy. I actually don't remember that, but that's pretty awesome. I didn't really realize that. But, well, because Patera was in the same, I believe he was in the same class as Flair. God, who else was in that class? Greg Gagne, I believe. And
Greg Gagne, Iron Sheik.
Yeah, Sheik was in that class, and I think Slaughter came after. But Vern trained a lot of guys. And I think the first point I kind of want to really make about Patera's career is, Patera is one of a small – Vern had a real hard-on for –
Yeah, I'll let you proceed now, yeah.
Okay. Vern had a real hard-on –
I'll let you proceed now, yeah.
he had a real hard-on for amateur talent. And not just necessarily amateur wrestlers, but guys who had legitimate athletic credentials. And really all promoters did back then. But I think Vern, you know, sometimes did almost to a flaw. Because there are other guys that came, you know, right around the same time as Patera or after, who were nowhere near as skilled as him or didn't have as good, you know, any kind of charisma, who Vern sort of treated the same way. But if you notice, like, if you look at some of the guys that came out of Vern's training camp, Ric Flair, Buddy Rose, Sergeant Slaughter, the Iron Sheik, even his own son, Greg, you know, tons of guys, big names, some of the biggest names in the history of the business, Steamboat, others, none of them was pushed as quickly as Patera. None of them. Every single one of those names, they were in the mid card. They were in the low mid card or opening match for at least 9-10 months, if not longer. For most part, over a year before they got any kind of push at all. What's really unique about Patera is he debuts in December of 72. His first technical main event is in Fargo, I think, like 3 days into his career. Now, to be fair, that's just a smaller spot show, not really indicative of anything else. But within 6 months, when he sort of goes away for a while, then re-debuts in the middle of February, and by the time you get to March and April, Patera's already a main event player in all the towns in the AWA, and halfway into his first year has actually main evented the Twin Cities at least once, if not twice. There's no
real... And doing a lot of work against Superstar Graham, right?
Yeah. Superstar Graham and Ivan Koloff were really his first two programs of any significance. So there's two huge names right there, right out of the gate. Of course, this is early in Billy Graham's career, before he was a huge, huge star, but he was already a big-time star. And it's really interesting...
He is a pretty huge star then, yeah.
Yeah, it's really interesting because, you know, the only two, the guys that are most comparable in terms of how they were pushed by Vern that quickly would probably be Brad Rangins and Chris Taylor. Chris Taylor, who came almost immediately after Patera as a wrestler, and then Brad Rangins was also a wrestler.
Yeah, was Taylor possibly in the same camp, or I think he might have been in the second one.
I can't remember if Taylor was in that camp or not. If you look at the results, what happens, and I think this is actually pretty clear if you look at the results, it can be easily inferred if nothing else. Patera got that push out of the gate. And like you said, he worked against Graham a lot. He worked against Ivan Koloff a lot. They put him in a lot of tag teams with other top stars, guys like the Crusher, who was absolutely on fire at that point as a draw. And he worked around the loop pretty much everywhere. He also did Patera also did a lot of Hawaii shows. He was, you know, on top or near the top for a lot of shows in Hawaii, which I assume Vern co-promoted with Russ Francis. But what happened is Taylor kind of took Patera's spot. You get the feeling that Vern was like, all right, now I've got an amateur wrestler here, not just a weightlifter. And Taylor sort of snuck in and took Patera's spot as the amateur that Vern was going to push. And that actually, it can be inferred that sort of led to Patera sort of slowly leaving the AWA.
And starting to do more in Mid-Atlantic and then New York as well, right?
So. Absolutely. I mean, the first place he went after the AWA, I mean, he did shows with Vern's crew in Hawaii. But aside from that, the first place he really went after the AWA was Houston and Texas in general. He had a relatively brief run there. They actually
Houston is Paul Bosch, right? Yeah.
Correct. Yeah, and they actually did and I think I don't know if Blanchard was promoting the Texas wrestling history is really fascinating to me because the offices were, you know, there was one big booking office, you know, as far as I know, but they all sort of split off into different individual territories all over the state.
Yeah.
But what happened is
almost its own little alliance, almost.
Yeah, it's like its own little fiefdom, exactly. Patera ended up, you know, farming out and working Superstar Graham some down there again, which tells you that feud was pretty hot because it was effectively farmed out. And then he also had a feud, down there with the Blackjacks for a little while. He also won his first title of any kind. It was a tag team title, I believe, with Tex McKenzie, I think, was his partner during that same time period. So that the Texas run was his first place. Besides the AWA, it was really a holdover. It wasn't a major period in his career other than the fact that it was the first time where he wasn't, you know, working under Vern, who was his trainee. Or trainer, rather.
I would like to know, too, that you sounded a little critical of, you know, Vern, some of Vern's selections, but you yourself have a hard-on for amateur, too, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, my point was, if you look at guys like
Sorry,
Chris Taylor.
You totally missed my porn joke.
Oh, damn it. Damn it. But
anyways, I'm just trying to answer
off. That was actually not a bad, yeah, we should do at least one porn joke every single show. And see if we can slip it in subtly, you know, on the last show, on the All Japan show. I actually got multiple comments, positive comments about our Crystal Gayle sex symbol talk. So, you know, we really have a constituency that's looking for this sort of perversion now. We can't let them down.
Yes,
but anyway.
I sat on that for a good 10 minutes too, actually. Which is not a subtle sex comment, but
no.
So we were back to Patera going to Texas, and then I mean, one of the things is, I mean, he came in. You know, I could say he was pushing because he had the Olympic background, but it seems like it worked too. Like it made him a draw, and you know, much like. I'd say Patera is much better than Mick Patera's do, unquestionably. But, you know, Dave Bautista says, you know, I definitely got the breaks I did because of my look, but I made the most of it, too. And Patera made it.
Yeah, I mean, Patera was a big guy, obviously, but he wasn't a bodybuilder guy, you know? I mean, he really wasn't.
No.
He had a good physique, but he was not a jack dude if you looked at him. He had real core strength and obviously was a bad guy, a bad motherfucker. But, he wasn't a...
And when he was... When he, When he was starting out, he still had the powerlifter physique too, right?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Which was actually, I think, kind of common back then. I mean, even Flair had that look when he started out, which is kind of funny in hindsight.
Well, I mean, Flair will say too. Flair was best friends with Patera at that point too, right?
Yep.
He said, you know, Patera was, he ate the same diet as Patera, just didn't have the same workout regimen, so.
Yeah. I mean, that's,
so he got fat.
That's another good point, too. And I think one of the real telling things when you look at the early Patera stuff is, like, you see Flair, and, like, Flair's in the opening match versus, like, some random guy. And meanwhile, like, Ken Patera's wrestling Billy Graham or teaming with the Crusher versus Billy Robinson and somebody in a main event, right? And it's just kind of funny because not that Patera didn't go on to be, like I say, a star with a really good career, but it's just kind of funny to think that Vern had Ric Flair, came out of the same camp, and Flair's, you know, pushing up daisies basically in the jobber role on the undercard, and you got Ken Patera, who I think is unfortunately remembered basically for his last year and a half as a wrestler. I don't think a lot of fans even remember anything other than that. In fact, I know they don't, just in talking to people in preparation for this show and for other things. And here he was. He was already a major star, and he's 6 months into his career. So it's kind of amusing. But anyway, I think the Olympian thing definitely was an advantage, and probably a good advantage. He earned it, I think, making it through that camp at that weight and probably not having the best cardio. If anybody knows anything about Vern Gagne's camp, I mean, that's impressive in and of itself.
Now, where did he first work as a heel? Was it Mid-Atlantic?
Or at least not so far as I can tell. When they originally brought him into Mid-Atlantic, he was like the Greenhorn All-American babyface. That's based on everything I've been able to figure out from talking to people who were around back then at the time, people in town, and even people in other places online. I've talked to a few people around here, actually, too. But he was originally brought in as sort of the All-American baby, almost a Bob Backlund kind of type. Not that extreme, but you get my point. He was brought in. He had a mini feud with Johnny Valentine. It was, you know, they did a small angle on TV to kind of set up some U.S. title matches. He had some really big matches versus Flair, who by that point, you know, this was, I guess, 75, by that point had hit Mid-Atlantic and was already a star after having left Vern in the interim. And, you know, he had some matches with Flair.
Wahoo dragged Flair there, right? So.
Yep. And, I mean, he
Wahoo
had some
McDaniel
really...
Wahoo dragged Flair there with him, so.
Dragged him behind his truck. But, no, but there was some good stuff. It was another case where Patera was not really the true top guy, and maybe not even quite in the top tier like he had been in the AWA, but, you know, Mid-Atlantic at that time was running a ton of shows, and they were running everywhere from Northern Virginia down, I think, to even, like, the Savannah, Georgia area. That's a pretty big area. You know, all over, up in the Blue Ridge Mountains of South Carolina to, you know, so there's a pretty big area there. And they were running shows, two shows a night, most nights. And Patera was headlining on some of those shows, absolutely. You know, he was getting headline matches both here in my hometown, teaming with Rufus Jones versus the Andersons. He was getting matches versus Flair for the U.S. title in the Mid-Atlantic belt matches. I mean, so he was getting main events, but he wasn't a true main eventer. Another thing that's kind of worth noting is that he his sort of de facto fallback opponent for part of 75 in Mid-Atlantic was Jerry Blackwell, when he had nobody else to wrestle.
Yeah,
he just sort of threw him against Blackwell, which I think is kind of cool, because, you know, later on they go on to be a pretty great tag team. But his first place where he worked heel was actually Leroy McGurk's promotion in, you know, Oklahoma. They brought him in, I want to say it was March of 76. My timeline could be a little bit off. But it was early 76. He sort of finished up in Mid-Atlantic. You could tell that he was slipping down the cards a little bit, not really a jobber, but sort of stuck in the mid-card. They had really no direction with him. And he shows up on TV there, and I was told this by somebody who remembers this from when the angle hit, and just destroys Bill Watts on TV with the swinging neckbreaker, which, you know, was basically the full Nelson while spinning around.
Okay.
And just absolutely destroyed
him. That, sorry, that's... such a great move that just doesn't get used.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great heel move. It looks brutal when it's applied by a real strong man. I remember Smoky Mountain when they brought in Bull Buchanan as the Punisher in 95, after Cornette turned on Bob Armstrong yet again. At the culmination of the Gangsters feud, there was a really awesome beatdown with where Bull Buchanan put that move on everybody, and I remember thinking, oh my God, this guy is so awesome, you know, and it was Bull Buchanan, but still, if it's done right, it really does look great, and I talked to somebody.
I mean, Bull Buchanan is a guy who didn't get used to his potential.
Oh no! I don't mean that as a knock on Bull Buchanan. I actually kind of like Bull Buchanan, but you know, I talked to somebody who saw the McGurk angle when they were growing up, I guess, and they said it was one of those horrifying things they'd seen as a kid, because here this hero, Bill Watts, who's like the hero of the territory, is, you know, there, and all of a sudden he's just being destroyed, and they sold it, apparently he was like bleeding from the mouth, and like, you know, one of those really over the top, like this guy might die style angles.
Yeah.
And it immediately made Patera a huge star in the territory of heel.
Well, I was going to say, he's not Bill Watts was no Spike Dudley, so I don't imagine doing spinning full Nelson is all that easy on him either. So imagine.
No, God, no. It must have looked insanely impressive. I mean, obviously no footage exists of it, but I imagine it had to look really impressive. And Watts, you know, they went around the horn with that down there in Oklahoma, in that territory. It wasn't just Oklahoma. I think they hit some spot shows elsewhere, although I don't think McGurk owned much of Louisiana and what would later become Mid-South. I could be wrong on that. But
yeah, I was going to say.
They did really good business from what I can tell. There's no real figures available, but I've heard from people that it was a really, really hot angle and hot storyline. And that really solidified Patera. From that point forward, I think promoters realized this guy, the money with this guy is as a heel. You know, I mean, like that was yeah, sort of the turning point. And whether or not, you know, you credit McGurk with realizing that, or maybe Watts had a hand in it, who knows? But I think that was really the turning point in Patera's career, because prior to that, he was an upper mid-carder pretty much everywhere he went, who would get his main events and you know, could be a drawing card if positioned against the right guy. But after that, he was a really hot commodity as a heel that a lot of territories really seemed to want. And you know, a guy that had a real value as a guy you could bring in as a major ass-kicking heel. And also, you know, at the very end of that run there, McGurk, he also got his first NWA title shot against Terry Funk, one of his last shows. So he definitely became a big star there. Yeah, I imagine that would have been awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was really his first place where he was a major star.
Did he go to New York next, or did
yes,
there another stop in between?
Yes, he went to
New York next. Yeah,
he went to New York effectively next.
Yeah,
I mean,
in all the interviews I've heard. Yeah, I was going to say all the interviews I've heard with Bruno Sammartino, with Dave Meltzer and Brian Alvarez, like, he's told that story a few times about how he had to convince Vince McMahon Sr. to bring in Patera as a headlining main eventer against him. And you know what? That's pretty impressive of him to do that, to pick him out of someone who just had a heel run in Oklahoma and say, let's bring him up to the Garden. And he had to talk him into it, and it was successful.
Yeah, and I think that's actually an interesting point. I mean, I should know we're missing a very minor Georgia run in there somewhere. That it was his first run in Georgia, but it didn't last very long. It was only for a couple of months. But it's
minor Patera.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a big deal. The next big place really is the WWF or WWF, and I actually didn't know the story about Bruno. Is there like more details on that story, or was it just Bruno saying, hey, look, this guy is somebody
we
should bring it?
No, correct me if I'm wrong, but their main event run, like, did good business, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Yes,
absolutely.
There's a story he's told about someone that he thought he would do good business with, and I think that's Bobby Duncan, where it didn't work out. And then he talks about how he had to convince McMahon Sr. to bring in Patera, and McMahon didn't think it would work out, and he said he brought him in, and they did great business together.
Pretty cool.
Someone he advocated for, and it worked out.
That's pretty cool. I actually didn't know that story.
If you haven't heard those interviews, he's a very smart man about the business, actually.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no question that Bruno's a bright guy.
Yeah.
He gets a bad rap.
And that,
that
was
people
kind of his, that was kind of one of his last real title title feuds too, with him as champion, was against Patera going into when he started feuding with Superstar Graham, right?
Yes, and Patera line is really interesting too, because basically he shows up at MSG and wrestles Bruno effectively on his first night in the company. I mean, there may be a date that's missing here or there, and I assume that there were some sort of pre-tapes that were sent in to build this guy up. Don't get me wrong. But so far as I can tell, Patera's first real night in the company was wrestling Bruno at Madison Square Garden, which is pretty insane.
You think about it, like, he's got the Olympic background, so that's going to work. He probably did some pre-takes that made him look like a heel. And, man, that guy's got great hair. So, of course, he's going to stop.
And he was with – I'm trying to remember who he was with at the time. God forgive me for this. I can't remember if it was the Grand Wizard in 77 or Albano. But that certainly didn't hurt. I mean, he had one of the three wise men with him. It was one of those two. I can't remember which. But, you know,
he was eventually with the Grand Wizard, and I would assume that he might have been then as well. But the only thing that would make me say he might not have been is that Graham was, and I think they tried to alternate the manager.
Yes, yeah.
Kind of like the villains on the old Hercules cartoon, you know?
I mean, I can't remember who he was with first, and that definitely would have helped. But I think one of the talking points that people have used over the years when talking about that territory, the WWWF, is, well, it was the title that drew, or, well, it was the company that drew, or, well, it was the managers that drew. I don't really think that's true. I think it was it was a big package.
Yeah.
There's no question about it. But there were certain guys that did better than other guys, and I think you have to acknowledge that. And Patera came in pretty much cold to the region and the territory, and immediately did very, very good with Bruno. He sort of filled, sort of took over the gap as it's weird because he was not really ever the top heel because they were grooming Billy Graham at the same time. But he superseded Stan Stasiak, in my view at least, pretty quickly, and became the number two heel, and he was a number two heel that could draw because he didn't just have good runs against Andre there. He had good runs against Bruno, but he had matches against Andre that did well. There were main events. He had matches against Dusty. In fact,
this is during that 76-77 run, right?
Yes. I mean, the Dusty stuff actually got farmed out. I want to say they brought the Dusty feud to Toronto. I know that he wrestled Dusty on the Super Bowl of Wrestling card in Florida too, and that was the second. That was not the main event, but it was the second match under the top. So it was a huge match on the show.
I read in the write up that they went to Toronto with it. So.
Yeah, I mean, like they took the Dusty match a few places, and Dusty, of course, at the time was a huge star also. And I think that's kind of the point with Patera. You can make the case that Patera was never the top guy in any promotion he was in. However, if you look at who he's working during this peak period, he's working Bruno, he's working Dusty, he's working Andre the Giant, he goes on to work Backlund. I mean, he's working everybody you would expect the top heel to work. And, Graham was the top heel in 77 because they were grooming him for a world title push, but Patera was clearly a draw. He was clearly a heel that was positioned to make money and that did make money and that made money against basically all the big dog baby faces that were up there. So it is myopic to say, well, he wasn't Billy Graham. I mean, so what? Saying he wasn't Billy Graham doesn't really mean anything.
This might upset you, but you know who it sounds like a bit?
Who's that?
Edge.
No, I actually think that's kind of a fair comparison in a way. I think it's a little bit different because with Edge, he was in the same company, but I think it is kind of a fair comparison, because he was the challenger or the key opponent repeatedly for the top guys. I don't think that's a stretch. I think that's in the neighborhood of being a reasonable comparison. I think it's always tough when you compare eras because there's so much different. You know, it's like my comparison between the erroneous comparison people always make between Portland and ECW, which I've seen many times because of the size of the venues and things like that.
Yeah,
I mean, I've talked about that elsewhere, and eventually we'll probably do a show on that sort of thing. But I think it's tough because the eras are so different. You can make comparisons, but there's only so far you can take them. But I don't think Edge is an unreasonable comparison if you're going to cross eras. I get your point.
Yeah. So.
So
Patera, did he do a lot of stuff with Andre at that point? Or?
It's weird. The Andre stuff, Andre was one of those guys he kind of came back to over the years. When he went to Mid-Atlantic here after the WWF stop, Andre was a guy he wrestled there. When Andre came down, he actually later, even in the AWA, during the Heenan family stuff, he would wrestle Andre on cards there. I think that was kind of a good go-to match because of the fact that Patera was a guy you could legitimately believe is overpowering Andre. You know, there weren't very many guys that you could believe. And on top of it, Patera was a good stooge and had no problem bumping like crazy for Andre. So, you know, it was a good – he was a credible offensive force versus the strongest or the biggest man on earth, which not very many people could say. You know, not very many people are Olympic weightlifters. So –
Then when you look at Andre going around the horn to different territories, and you know, I assume he would probably like to work with people he was familiar with too.
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement. Yeah, and Patera, like I said, you know, it wasn't just the Bruno stuff in '77, although that's the stuff that did the best business, but that Dusty stuff too. I mean, they did good business in Toronto. And to me, almost the most important result from Patera during that time period is the Super Bowl of Wrestling show in Florida, because he's wrestling Dusty Rhodes on this huge super show, second from the top. The idea that a guy who, in some people's opinion, didn't have that good of a career would have wrestled Dusty Rhodes at the height of his popularity in Florida, second from the top on, you know, at that time, one of the biggest shows in the history of wrestling, is laughable. I mean, he was pretty clearly a huge star at that point. I just don't see any way you could argue against it.
Yeah.
'77, you know, kind of builds off '76 as a really major year for Patera.
Still in with the McMahon, right?
Yes. Yeah. That was McMahon pretty much all the way. Mm-hmm. And then
I think it was pretty much from there that he probably went down. Like I know in some of those Cornette garbage tapes from of Mid-Atlantic, the ones that Cornette dug out of the garbage when they were thrown there. Like you see some footage of him in Mid-Atlantic there in the '70s. So
yeah,
I assume he kind of went there in the next while.
Yeah, what happened is, I mean, the thing in '77, the Billy White Wolf angle on TV, which was a huge deal up north, and I think probably single-handedly won him PWI's Most Hated Wrestler of the Year. I mean, like, the Bruno feud and the Dusty matches probably didn't hurt, but he became, you know, I mean, that was really put him over the top as, like,
this is,
awful hate.
Is this 77 or 78?
That's still 77. And he won PWI Most Hated Wrestler of the Year in '77, which is a pretty big compliment, because even though it's a kayfabe award, they didn't just give that away. I mean, you had to be a huge star to even get that award.
No, they thought about it, yeah.
And, you know, basically the angle
Billy White, Billy White Wolf. Who else was Billy White Wolf?
Oh, God, I don't even remember. I know he was a tag champ in
he's
events.
Not, was he tag champs with Chief J. Strongbow, of course?
I honestly don't remember. I think it was J. Strongbow. But I don't have the results in front of me.
So I think that's Skandor Akbar, isn't it? Isn't Billy White Wolf Skandor Akbar?
I don't think so, no. I don't think it is Akbar.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure it's a different guy.
I need to go past
Google here. I'm almost positive it's a different guy. You can look it up and prove me wrong, but I'm almost positive it's a different guy. But the angle was that basically White Wolf got destroyed with the swinging net breaker yet again. You know, the same sort of Bill Watts angle that they'd done before. And, you know, White Wolf got put out, and that was really hot for them around the horn too, was, you know, people trying to get revenge for Billy White Wolf against Kim Patera. That was another thing that sort of added to his ability to make money for Vince. He didn't necessarily even have to be against the very top guy, because he was so hated because of that angle with White Wolf, that if they put him in there with any of those top tier heels, even somebody like Ivan Putski, he could do good business on you know, in pretty much anywhere. Because, I mean, you know, Patera headlined all the major arenas. He headlined Philadelphia, Boston, Baltimore, Pittsburgh, et cetera.
So Billy White Wolf was not Skander Akbar. He was General Adnan LKC.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
Now, what was the angle again? What happened?
It was I've seen it. I've seen clips of it, but it was basically a rehash or similar to the Bill Watts angle. You know, he comes out and puts him in the swinging net breaker, you know, breaks his neck or whatever the angle was, and takes him out of wrestling. And then it becomes the story of Billy White Wolf, A, sort of trying to come back, and B, you know, the various baby faces trying to avenge him. So it was a good, very good and important storyline for WWF at the point. And I tell you right now, I've seen very little of any of this stuff. You know, this whole Patera thing to me, it's kind of funny because it's not even as if Kim Patera is one of my favorite wrestlers. He's really not. I like Kim Patera's work, especially in 1980, but with the Sheiks. But he's hardly like my very favorite wrestler. He's just, to me, he's kind of a perfect example of one of these guys that he sort of slips through the cracks, and people forget how big of a deal he was because of how, frankly, how unfortunate his career ended up the last couple of years. You know, being seen in the boom period the way he was seen, you know, people tend to forget that at the height of the territory era, he was a major, major star. And that's kind of, you know, what the whole purpose of this for me was.
I know I can say for myself, my first exposure to him was late 86, early 87, I guess it was, it was into 1987 when they did the whole thing where he got released from jail and talked about what a bad influence Bobby Heenan was on him. And then he came in and did the feud with the Heenan family. But it was in that era, in that period, probably the next year when I actually, my cousin and I rented the History of the Intercontinental Championship, and I saw the historical stuff of him to heel, and I was like, this guy's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of is funny because obviously that's what I saw, you know, as a kid, the Heenan family, the feud with the Heenan family, you know, and all that stuff, and I'll build up to that, but I think it's interesting how that came off too, because that could have been more than it was. But I don't want to get too far ahead, but that could have been more than it was, and that was also my introduction to Patera. But and you're right, by the way, that the next place he went was Mid-Atlantic. After this run with Vince and Vince Sr. in 77, he did go to Mid-Atlantic, where he was around for, I guess it was a couple of years. I don't, like I said, I don't have my notes in front of me. I'm doing all this from memory. I hope I'm doing a pretty good job. I think I'm staying pretty true to the timeline.
Yeah.
But, you know, 78 and 79, he was a big star in Mid-Atlantic. And I think one of the most fascinating things about the Mid-Atlantic, I believe he came in and almost immediately won the title from Wahoo, the Mid-Atlantic title. I mean, almost immediately, in Greensboro, if I'm not mistaken. And they, but what was really interesting about Patera is he held the Mid-Atlantic title on and off for almost his entire run. And that was not the top belt in the territory. You know, Mid-Atlantic was kind of a tag team territory, always was. The U.S. title was in many ways the top belt there. Especially during that period. But Mid-Atlantic belt meant a lot. It wasn't just a worthless piece of junk either. And back then, titles actually meant things. I know that's kind of novel now. But it's weird to say this because if you look at his feuds, you know, at this point, he'd already feuded with Bill Watts in Oklahoma. He feuded with Bruno. He basically had a feud with Dusty because of how it was set up. You know, he had this hot feud coming out of the White Wolf angle in 77 with almost the entire face roster of the WWF.
But really, in some ways, his most successful feud up until 1980 was his feud with Tony Atlas in Mid-Atlantic. It was a feud that really went on for a while and was expected to really, you know, carry certain towns in the territory. It wasn't all, you know, necessarily the main event, but it was co-main event on a lot of shows in the semi-main slot. It was main event many times, but and it's kind of, you know, Tony Atlas, of course, is sort of another guy that's sort of laughed at now, but was a huge star at the time. I mean, I was talking to somebody the other day about.
I will admit to laughing at him.
I think everybody kind of laughs at him at the time. By the way, I loved him during his last WWF run. I don't care who knows. I thought that was great. But you know,
Do you mean 2008, 2009, or
yes? No, I loved him as Mark Henry's guy, and I loved him as the Abraham Washington Show host. Intro dude. I thought he was awesome. Both in both roles. I don't care what anybody says, but it's funny because I was talking to somebody about Tony Atlas, and they were like, you know, look, Tony Atlas was awesome when I was a kid. He was like, you know, he was like Hulk Hogan before Hulk Hogan. I mean, obviously that's an exaggeration, but he was a huge star. He had this great look, was really over. I mean, people thought he was going to be the next big thing in pro wrestling. So on paper, you go, oh, well, wow, he had a feud with Tony Atlas. But if you actually look at it from the context of the time, having a feud with Tony Atlas that lasted that long and drew money is actually fairly impressive. I mean, that was a big name in wrestling during the period. And the angle that they did to set up the feud was great. I don't know if you've ever seen it. And for people, I'll post a YouTube clip of it in the Wrestling Culture podcast thread when we the various websites where we post this. Because it really is awesome. It's Ken Patera does this feats of strength challenge where he like bends a metal bar and blows up this hot water bottle, you know, until it pops and does all these like, you know, amazing feats of strength, right? Cool. And of course Tony Atlas matches
throws a rock through a restaurant window.
Yeah.
he throws
a gigantic boulder through a restaurant window. but he does all these like amazing, you know, and they are pretty amazing. He like drives a nail through a board with his hand, you know, all this very carnival type strength stuff, you know, stuff that, you know, kind of like the World's Strongest Man competition, which he did as well, you know, that kind of stuff. And Tony Atlas comes out and matches it. And like the whole time, Tony Atlas is doing these like really like, you know, taunting like dances and just kind of like, but he's being like, aw shucks, you know, oh Ken, I don't know if I can do that. And then he'll like succeed and like dance in Ken's face. And Patera the whole time is like gradually getting angrier and angrier. And at first he's just like, oh, Tony Atlas, you've got a good body, but you're just a bodybuilder. You don't have any real core strength. You're not really you know. And then, of course, Tony eventually bends the big bar and Patera tries to attack him and Atlas gives him a headbutt and, you know, that kind of sets up their feud. But it's really a great old school angle that they execute on Mid-Atlantic TV. And Tony Atlas was so over as a babyface. And there's another, you know, there's another clip that I'll throw in this thread, too, to give people an idea of how over Patera was as a heel in Mid-Atlantic. So, yeah, I mean, this will, I think, kind of prove that I'm not just talking out of my ass.
I'm just thinking this off the top of my head, but I can't think that at that point of being about 1978 that there's any, with the exception of Superstar Graham, Tony Atlas was probably the biggest bodybuilder in the division at that point.
I mean, he was, you know, Mr. Universe, right? I mean, like, this guy was...
Yeah,
it's almost amazing.
At a point when that wasn't overexposed, so it would have been a big deal, right?
Yeah, and it really is almost amazing to look at Atlas then. You're like, Jesus. Because, I mean, there's other guys that look strong, don't get me wrong, and other guys that have nice bodies, but good God. I mean, like, he was freakish.
He must have taken a lot of amino acids.
it was the women's feet. Please tell me you know about that, Tony Atlas's foot fetish. Please tell me you know about that.
I know about that from you mentioning it quite a few times.
Oh man, you gotta Google. You gotta YouTube it. Oh God, Bixen Span sent me a
link. I've heard about it.
Oh my God. But anyway,
Another thing I'll post in the thread is there's a clip somebody posted on a message board the other day of a Wrestling Classics of Ricky Steamboat. It's a match with Steamboat and Patera from either 78 or 79. And it's a title match of some sort, probably a Mid-Atlantic title match. Man, it's just the last few minutes of it. Really good what's shown. Patera sort of, you know, it's, you know, your screw job type finish deal. And the crowd literally almost riots. They run up to the ring. They totally surround the ring. They're beating on the ring, screaming at the ref. And Tommy Young, in a pretty much a genius move, raises Steamboat's hand really quick to give the appearance that he'd won the match, while Patera is being, like, ushered out as quickly as possible by the cops. it's kind of cool because you can get a look at both Carolina wrestling from the period and also how over Patera was as a heel. He literally being scooted away by the police escort before he's killed. But the Atlas feud was a big deal. He worked with Wahoo a lot during that period. And again, during that period, he was headlining in Greensboro and Charlotte.
Atlas comes into play again later, but
yes, you know, and he was headlining in Greensboro, he was headlining in Charlotte, he was headlining in all the big towns as well as some of the smaller towns. Was he Ric Flair? No, again, he was not the top guy, and I can't stress that enough because I don't want to be accused of exaggerating. But he was a key player in Mid-Atlantic during that period, and was clearly one of the top draws in that territory.
And I think one of the things is by this point, he's not just an Olympic strongman. He has become a very good worker.
Absolutely.
I mean, anything from that point on that you see up till his later leave of absence, we shall say, in the mid to late 80s, he was fantastic.
Absolutely.
Didn't need to be. I mean, with his background, it's like that's what's so great about it.
That's very true. Very, very, very true. And, I'll tell you right now, I'm not going to remember every aspect of his career. I've got, you know, a gigantic thread over at Pro Wrestling Only where I've gone through every single year so far up through 85. I actually have the results from 87, 88, and 89 done, but I just haven't, you know, data dumped them yet. I'll get to it this week. But, 85 is really the last key year of his career anyway. But, he was definitely a good worker at that point and a really good overall pro wrestler. I mean, there's no question about it. By the time you get into we don't have the footage from the McGurk run, but I would venture to guess by the time he left Watts working with Bill Watts, he was already a pretty complete package. By the time you get 78, 79, you can really see it.
And I think there's some footage of him against Bruno because there's a lot of the MSG footage from that.
Yes.
Too.
Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely some 77 stuff that's out there, but anyway, the 70. You know, he worked everybody in Mid-Atlantic. Atlas was his biggest opponent. He did then go on to have a feud with Dino Bravo that was, I assume, and I don't know this, but predicated basically on the same sort of thing. You know, strongman versus strongman. During the territory days, that's kind of how it worked. You found the niche, and then you sort of ran with it, and then when things got stale, you went somewhere else. But the point is, Patera had a very, very good run as a heel there in Mid-Atlantic. And even though he drew more money in 77 versus the big dogs up north, in a lot of ways you could argue that 78 he was more important. During that hero in 78, 79 in Mid-Atlantic, you could argue in some ways he was more important because up north they did have Billy Graham and they did have Bruno and they had these guys, whereas, you know, Mid-Atlantic, not that they didn't have stars, but Patera, to me, you know, looking at the results and seeing, what I've seen from both places, he stood out more in Mid-Atlantic as a guy that you really felt like the company needed. I'm not saying they didn't need him in 77 up north with the business he did, but it's sort of a different perspective, I guess.
And at that point, I think you could safely say that it was still at that point that Mid-Atlantic had a lot of tag teams, but you know, he was one of those strong singles guys at that point, probably.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was transitioning from some from being a pure tag territory at that point. You know, when he had been there in 75,
yeah.
It was much more of a tag territory in my view, because that was really the height of the Andersons and stuff. But it was still, tag teams were a big emphasis, even in 78,
yeah.
79. And,
you still have your Ricky Steamboat and Paul Jones kind of,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, Patera, like I said, he worked them all. He worked every star you could think of in that period. Like I said, they bring Andre down for shows during that period to work Patera. You know, he worked Wahoo several times, including winning the belt off of him. Again, kind of like with Bruno on one of his, not necessarily his first night in the company, but one of his early nights in the company at one of the first really big shows, he won the belt off Wahoo, just like he'd, you know, not won the belt, but main evented versus Bruno on one of his first nights in WWF. So he was a guy, he did a lot of strong debuts. You know,
I think a lot of people would prefer getting the main event against Bruno in the Garden over winning any title anyway. But the money that probably came with that. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's something that would be more impressive than winning the Mid-Atlantic title. Although, you know, Greensboro is a big venue and
great
a historic venue. So. But anyway, you know.
Now, 78 and 79, did he start making forays up to St. Louis at that point too?
I honestly don't have the results right in front of me. I'm trying to remember when he first started to hit St. Louis. And it was around this time frame, but I can't remember exactly when it was.
I would assume he was up there a little bit because we know 1980 he was, and I assume he was a little established by that time.
I want to say he hit St. Louis for the first time in 79, but I could be wrong. He may have worked a little bit before there. You know, 80 is kind of really the big year. I mean, we're basically right there. Because 80 is the year where I think, you know, I've talked to people, and there, you know, some people say that Patera was actually in line to be NWA champion. Now, this has been said about so many people that you kind of have to take those claims with a grain of salt. I mean, even the David Von Erich rumor, which for years was treated like the ordained word of God, like you couldn't possibly question it, there's 100% truth to it, has subsequently sort of, I don't want to say been shot holes in to the point of being not believable at all, but it's been heavily scrutinized to the point where I don't think it's any longer is an absolute truth. But I do know for an absolute fact.
I think people really overdosed on that idea.
Yeah. Well, you know, they binged on it. But I do want to say
they had their fill of it.
Oh, my God. The Von Erich jokes on it. We're going to have no people listening to this in Texas. I will say that Patera, well, I wouldn't go so far as to say he was definitely considered a key of guy, oh, yeah, the NWA title's going to go on this guy. You can envision him being a name that was being mentioned in those board meetings. I mean, you absolutely can, because he was so effective as a heel. He'd done so well for three or four straight years now. He'd never really been an undercard worker. There was no stigma that he was going to go into a territory and people were going to remember him as some guy that had lost in the opening match for 10 straight weeks. I mean, he really was good on the mic at the time period. He was much better, you know, sort of the traditional stooging world champion type guy. And I've heard from people that, you know, would definitely be privy to at least inside rumors as opposed to pure outside speculation, that Patera definitely was considered for the NWA title in 80 to 81. I mean, I've absolutely heard that. Whether from people who are not purely speculators like me and you, from people who actually have, you know, well-placed connections inside the business. Whether or not that was a serious consideration is debatable. But I think if you look at 1980, you can really say, boy, maybe that was definitely true. Because when you look at 1980, you see, I think, one of the most underrated runs in any single year for any wrestler in United States wrestling history. That's as a total package, not just as a draw, not just as a character, not just as a worker, but as all three. I think he was really the total package at that point in his career. And, you know, if you ask me to pinpoint Kim Patera's prime, I would say 77 through 1980, maybe even through the early parts of 81. But 80 would be the absolute peak of the peak. You know, that would be the pinnacle of the peak, the absolute high point. You've seen some of it, Dave. I mean, how much of the matches and stuff have you seen from Patera in 1980?
I've seen a little bit of his IC stuff. I've seen when he won the title from Patterson, the Continental title, and he won that at Madison Square Garden. I started watching the other night, but kind of ran out of time. The next month, back at Madison Square Garden, he was the challenger for Backlund.
Yeah.
And for the world title, and he was saying, "I'm going to hold all the belts," and it was kind of put over that he'd won the month before there, and. I don't think that was a Texas Death Match, but maybe that was. But he eventually did a Texas Death Match with Backlund as well, and kind of renowned as really good matches.
Oh yeah,
and,
really great.
I know
matches.
Just something I haven't seen, but that I know of is just after he won the Intercontinental title, he also won the Missouri title in St. Louis from Kevin
Van
Aerts.
Correct.
And the idea of doing both of those at the same time is pretty remarkable. What were you going to say?
I was going to say that I think that is actually pretty. That's almost the equivalent of holding a world title. But anyway, go ahead.
I was
going to
say
your point.
The closest thing you could have to that is being NWA or WWF champion at the time.
Yeah,
like,
I mean. That's. I don't think that's an exaggeration. I mean, if you look at I can't remember. I wish I had my results in front of me.
Because the other thing is he didn't just hold those two titles. He was also main eventing the Garden against Backlund.
Absolutely, and it goes beyond that even. I mean, all that everything we just said would be impressive. Everything we just said, but you know, first of all. The Texas Death Match with Backlund was the Observer Wrestling the Observer Match of the Year for 1980. Now at that point, Dave was just picking the matches himself, if I'm not mistaken. There was no vote, and I personally don't think that was the best match of the year in 1980. But it's an awfully good match. It's right up there near the top, and the fact that that match won, I think, is a real testament because if anybody knows Dave Meltzer, they know he's not the biggest Bob Backlund fan. Not trying to take a cheap shot at Dave Meltzer, but I think that is a pretty fair conclusion to draw from the way Dave has talked about and covered Bob over the years. Okay, I don't think that is mean-spirited or inaccurate in the least. So for him to give the Match of the Year award to a guy he was really not a fan of, that speaks pretty highly about the match, okay? But the whole feud with Backlund did huge business, just like the feud with Bruno had done. So here he's back there in New York, and again, he's against the world champion in the big arenas, and he's doing huge business with him. Then he wins the Intercontinental title, like you said. So he's got this belt, which at the time, the Intercontinental title was still a relatively new title, but it meant a lot. It was a huge belt. And then he goes, like you said.
Well, he was the second champion.
Yes, after Patterson. Well, we don't know if anybody had the title first in Rio de Janeiro, but then he goes to St. Louis, where he's already established, wins the Missouri title. The thing about the Missouri title is if you look at the lineage of the belt, almost everybody who held the Missouri title was either an NWA champion before, after, or somebody that was supposedly strongly considered for the NWA title. I mean, it's pretty much a who's who of major stars within the National Wrestling Alliance during that time period. And for Patera to hold that belt and the Missouri – and he's getting NWA title shots during all this in Missouri also, or in St. Louis also, I might add. So he's headlining the Keel, you know, and he's headlining – I mean, and he's also headlining, I believe, against in Maple Leaf Gardens during this run too. Versus Backlund, if I'm not mistaken. They're farming him out the Maple Leaf, and him and Backlund are working up there as well. So,
you know, he's in multiple places as a major star. He's got two of the top titles in the business, both of which are sort of, you know, the Intercontinental title would not be seen as a feeder title yet because it was too new. But I think the assumption was, if you can carry the Intercontinental title, you might be somebody that we have in line for the world title later. Of course, WWF was never a heel territory, so that's hard to say. But the Missouri title was certainly seen as a feeder title for the NWA world title. I don't even think that's arguable. And he's got both. He's having these great matches, Drawing versus Backlund. Of course, in the midst of all of this, Larry Zbyszko and Bruno Sammartino's feud explodes. You know, they do that huge feud in 1982. So now you've got Bruno's back on the scene. Big time, you know, feud with Larry Zbyszko that's drawing big numbers also around the horn. So now you got this whole package deal where you got Larry, Bruno, Backlund, and Patera. And Patera would then go on and have another run versus Bruno in 1980, which was very successful, where they drew huge crowds as well. And to me, one of the most impressive things that in Patera's entire run is he also feuded with Pedro Morales that year. So he feuded with all three of the major WWF champions during that time span that were babyfaces. Obviously, Billy Graham doesn't count. He wasn't even a heel. But all three of your major WWF babyface champions in the same year, all of them did mega heat. All of them do very well at the box office. And you know, one of the most impressive things to me about Patera that year is toward the end of the year, there was a really weak MSG card. And I don't remember all the details on it, but Backlund was overseas. He was in Japan, if I'm not mistaken, defending the WWF title over there. And Patera was basically called upon to headline versus Morales in sort of a grudge match. There may have even been a stiff behind it, a lumberjack match or something. And they did 19,000 in the Garden. Now, some people would say, well, at that point, the Garden was doing 21, 22. You know, sometimes they were doing 26, 27 if you combine the Felt Forum. But the point is, that was a very weak show. They had no world champion present. The undercard was nowhere near as good as the undercard on almost any other Madison Square Garden show during the year. And on the strength of Patera and Morales alone, which was a secondary title feud, not the world title, they did 20,000 people in Madison Square Garden. To me, that is a very impressive number. That easily, in subsequent years when things like that happened, attendance was nowhere near as good as MSG. I mean, you can look at attendance during the Hogan years, later down the road where they only did 15 or 16 for shows that have much better cards. So, to me, 19 to 20,000 off the strength of that feud with no Backlund and with a very weak undercard is a really, really impressive result. I think 1980 Ken Patera, he had good matches with Tony Atlas also again that year. You know, we said we get about it again.
Yeah, what I was going to mention is, you watch the Shea Stadium card. And that is the absolute highlight of the entire show to me. Ken Patera is IC champion to defend against Tony Atlas.
It's a good match.
You watch
it,
and it's just like, yeah. And Patera is just like, this is a guy at his absolute peak of his game when you see him.
Absolutely. I mean, I really think
just being the coolest man in a building like that, you know.
I really think Patera is in 1980 had just so many good matches, and against guys who you would not normally think of. I mean, I'm sort of in between on Backlund. I don't think he's as great as some of his biggest adherents, but I think he was clearly a very good professional wrestler, and I don't want to hear anything to the contrary. I mean, to me, Bob Backlund was a very good in-ring performer, borderline great at times, but
With the right opponent was great, you know.
Yeah, I mean, those Patera matches are right up there with his best matches. They're not my favorite Backlund matches, but they're very close. In the upper stratosphere of my favorite Backlund stuff. And, you know, then he had the good match with Tony Atlas, who was hardly considered a good worker, really, at any point of his career. And he had good matches with Bruno, who was in his waning days. He had good match with Pat Patterson, who, to be fair, was still a good worker, but was also in his waning days, and good match with Morales, who at that point nobody really thought much of in the ring. I mean, it's not as if Patillo was wrestling, Bret Hart every night, or Rick Martel, yeah, or Nick Bockwinkel, or somebody who you know every single night is going to be with you step for step. He was wrestling guys who were very talented, but not considered great in-ring performers.
And then he's going to St. Louis and working with Kevin Von Erich, who was a very young Kevin Von Erich at that point, in 1980.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so,
I mean,
he was young
3 years later when...
Yes.
He was young 3 years later when the world class was at its peak, so...
Yeah, I don't want to undersell St. Louis stuff. I just don't have the results in front of me, but he was consistently a main event or semi-main event guy there for several years. Main eventing in the Keel was a huge deal. That's not just something some guy walked off the street and did. I mean, that was a huge, huge deal to main event the Keel Auditorium underneath Sam Mushnick and the people out there, that basically the epicenter of the NWA. To main event there even once would have been a big deal. To do it multiple times and to be in the semi-main event multiple times and to have multiple NWA title matches and to win the Missouri title, I mean, that in and of itself is extremely impressive, even independent of anything else we've discussed. So
because he main evented there so much, I think we can take for granted that Bulldog Bob Brown probably hated him.
I actually looked, and you know, the Central States results are a little bit more difficult to find than some of these other promotions. I looked to see if Patillo ever worked Central States, and I don't think he ever worked Central States, which means he probably had the good sense to stay away from the booking prowess of Bob Brown, because I'm pretty sure Bob Brown booked, I know he was at least part owner of Central States, but he didn't...
He was part of the office there.
He didn't have to deal with that. Patillo worked a lot of places over the years, but he did not have to deal with that. So, anyway, I guess, I don't even know. How long have I been yammering? What time is it?
hour and a half.
Okay.
Hour and a half,
right.
Almost. So we can keep going. I mean, we got lots to cover. So.
I want to get through the whole career. I do want to get through the whole career. So, 81.
In 1981, he basically goes to AWA, right?
Well, I mean, yes, but there is one key stop-off, and I don't know a lot of details on this. I should have asked Chris Zellner or somebody who would know, who's really good with – I mean, Chris Zellner is awesome with match results, and especially Southern wrestling history. He's not as good as it gets, but our Lucha history for that matter too. But he was in Georgia for a while, and he had a couple of feuds there of note, including with Tommy Rich in 1981. Which would have been a big deal. Yeah.
Dylan, why don't you talk a little bit about his Georgia run while I pretend I'm not putting the phone down for a second.
Sure, absolutely. Get the granola bar. But anyway, he was, in 81, he was sort of a strange year because he was still a big star in St. Louis, still having some major matches in St. Louis. You know, he finished up and lost the Intercontinental title and the Missouri title within a very small window of time. I want to say in late 1980. Might have been early 81. I can't remember off the top of my head. But then he went to Georgia in 81, and he had a couple of feuds to note, the most important of which would have been with Tommy Rich, who in 1981, Georgia was, one of the big stars in wrestling, period. I mean, at that point, Tommy Rich would have been becoming one of the first national stars in some ways. He's a big star through both the magazine universe and other places. And in 81, Patera actually won the PWI Most Hated Wrestler of the Year again, which he'd won in 77. Now, I kind of get the feeling that's because of the voting time period, and that he was given the 81 PWI Most Hated Wrestler of the Year based on some of the stuff that occurred in 80 with Pedro and Bruno and Backlund.
And you know, I can't imagine he got that just off the strength of a relatively brief feud with Tommy Rich. But he did win the PWI Most Hated Wrestler Award again in 1981. So, again, it was probably just a...
I'm back, by the way.
Okay. It was probably just a quirk of timing in terms of when the award was voted, because I'm sure most of that had to do with his stint in 1980. But he did win that award again in 81. So that's sort of another relevant kayfabe award that he got, gives an indication of how big a star he was at that point in business. But the Tommy Rich feud,
he won
kind of
in 1980 as well.
He won in 81, and I assume it was because
okay.
I assume it was because of the stuff in 1980. I say it has to be a quirk of the timing, you know, of when the votes were cast, because it just doesn't make sense that anything he did in 81 would have won him the award. Not that he wasn't a relevant player in 81. He was still a big star in St. Louis, and the Tommy Rich feud was there. But I don't think the Tommy Rich feud in 81 would have got him that award. That had to be based on stuff from New York from the previous year. But 81, it's kind of weird because he finishes up in Georgia, and it's kind of a no-show. And I think it looks, based on the results, like he might have taken a St. Louis show over a Georgia show, and that was it. He was never in Georgia again. But, you know, in fact, the title that he was supposed to be defending was forfeited to Tommy Rich on what would have been his last Georgia show, I guess. And then he had a brief stopover in Texas. A lot of the results aren't there. I want to say around this time is when he maybe had his first New Japan run too. Basically, he goes to the AWA as his home base in 81. He's back home in the AWA by, I guess, the midpoint of the year in 81. And goes forward there really
burns over
for the next couple of years.
Burns over Chris Taylor, but. Burned over Chris Taylor by this time.
Yeah, he's had enough of Chris Taylor, but he's about to get really pumped about Brad Rangins. So,
yeah,
you know, it's kind of the middle ground here. But yeah, so and then in 81 he goes in and AWA is such a weird territory. I think it, to somebody who didn't grow up in it and who didn't watch the stuff, because in other territories, it always feels like there's a top guy and then like three or four other guys that rotate around that top guy with that top guy as the central figure. And I'm not saying that's not how the AWA was, but in watching the footage, and which I'm watching all of it for people who don't know, for the Death Valley Driver Best of the 80s DVD project, the AWA is the card I drew along with Portland, so I'm watching everything we can find from the 1980s of the AWA. It doesn't feel quite that way. It feels different. It's a territory where there really seems like there's 9 or 10 guys at any given time that they sort of plug into that top spot to headline shows, you got your legend guys like your Crushers, your Mad Dog Vachons, your Dick the Bruisers. Then you got your world champ Bockwinkel traveled and defended the title far more than people remember. I mean, the NWA champion is the guy that people remember as the traveling champion, but Bockwinkel was gone a lot. He was defending the title in Houston and Memphis and Stampede and All Japan. You know, I mean, he traveled and defended that belt a lot of other places. So he was not always there. They needed other people to pick up the slack. You know, there's just a ton of guys.
And Vern is retired. Vern is retired by this time too, right?
Basically, yes. I mean, Vern had about 50 retirement matches. I mean,
This is after he retired and they then named Bockwinkel champion.
Yes. I mean, Bockwinkel was your ace.
Yes.
If that's what you're asking, yes. Bockwinkel was your ace. But Bockwinkel was a great wrestler, by the way. Much better than I think some people give him credit for. But Bockwinkel was the ace of the territory, but it was such a weird world because it wasn't like, you know, I mean, there are big chunks of time where Bockwinkel is not really working the night-to-night circuit because he's in Stampede for a week and a half or 2 weeks, or he's in Memphis, or he's, you know, in Houston. it's not like he's never there, but there are big chunks where he's gone, and they, you know, the AEW is very much a tag team territory too, which a lot of people don't realize. I mean, absolutely a tag team territory, and tag team matches often headlined in every town. Not just, you know, I mean, the major towns for the AWA were are the consistent Luke towns were Milwaukee, Green Bay, Chicago, the Twin Cities area of Minneapolis, St. Paul, you know, and then really as time went on, they started hitting Salt Lake City a lot and other places like that. Salt Lake City was actually a really consistent town for them. But Denver,
don't,
places like that.
Don't forget Winterpeg, Manitoba.
I was just about to say the other place was, you know, north of the border in Winnipeg, and you know, at various times, you know, they actually sort of expanded a little bit in Winnipeg, and, you know, did shows in Brandon and a couple other towns up there, but the AWA was, you know, if you had a good tag team partner, you would main event a lot. If you could get yourself into a solid tag team, you would main event a lot. And the story of Patera from this run, from 81 to 84 when he left, is as a guy who got himself good tag team partners and main evented a lot. Now, it was clearly a step down. By this point, I hate to say he was on the decline of his career because he was still a big star and a big part of the AWA, but he was, you know, I mean, he had two roles for almost this entire AWA run until he gets hooked up with the Sheiks in 83. And the two roles were consistent tag team guy wrestling the High Flyers or whoever, or maybe, Mad Dog and the Crusher or some Legends combination, and a main event or semi-main event role. That was consistent. Or as gatekeeper for Nick Bockwinkel.
Who would he be teaming with in those times?
In 81, his original partner was Bobby Duncan, which is kind of interesting because you said that was sort of the guy that Bruno sort of said, well, you know,
yeah.
Patera. So, but Bobby Duncan was his original partner in 81. And they did solid business. They were never the focal point of the company. They were never as big a tag team as the High Flyers or the Sheiks would later be, but they were a big heel team that was a credible heel team that people really believed could win the tag belts. I mean, they did some good business in town. I want to say Salt Lake City, especially a couple times, they did really big houses, either on the top or second from the top versus the Flyers. But the High Flyers, Gagne and Brunzel. But you know, it's mm-hmm. interesting because he really had two roles in 81. You know, I've talked a lot, I may have mentioned this to you off air about how in wrestling, sometimes some of the more important guys are not necessarily the very, very top stars, but the guys that have roles that are hard to fill. And the guy I always point to in the modern context is Rey Mysterio. I think it's not a surprise that the WWE has kind of suffered in Rey's absence because Rey fills lots of roles. He's a big merchandise guy. He's hugely over with the kids. He's sort of the last guy that connects the old school fans with the Nitro Raw era. He's a guy that I think Dolph Ziggler is sort of trying to replace as every single night. You know, he can have a good match. You know, so he's got multiple roles that have value to the company, and I think when he's not around, it really hurts, and it's evident in the product. Well, Patera had two clear roles. He was sort of the tag team partner. Of various, a key tag team wrestler for the whole run. And on top of that, he was the gatekeeper for Nick Bockwinkel. You know, when Nick Bockwinkel was about to have a guy that was going to work against him for the world title, Patera seemed to be the guy they would have to wrestle first. Whether it be Hogan or Martel or other guys, they seemed to package Patera as sort of, you have to get through. And I don't know how much that comes across on TV necessarily. But if you look at the results, the implication is there. You know, I mean, Bockwinkel was managed by Heenan. Heenan also managed Patera, and you'd really get the feeling that was sort of Patera's role. He was the guy that, you know, was supposed to build up these guys for Bach. And he got a lot of main events versus Hogan and versus other Keith guys in that role.
That would have been fun, him and Hogan at that point.
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, unfortunately, I've not really unearthed a singles match between those two. I've got a few six-mans where they have some fun interactions. But that 81 through 83 period is interesting because Patera is still, you know, his first partner during that period is Bobby Duncombe. And like I said, they had some major headline shows. And by the way, this whole time, he's still a big star in St. Louis. You know, he's still a main eventer or semi-main eventer the whole time. And then his next partner is Jesse Ventura. The Jesse Ventura run is the shortest of the three tag runs. But again, it was a key run with Patera and another big heel, another bodybuilder. Well, not that Patera was a bodybuilder, but another muscly heel. And, you know, there's some very good interviews during that period, as you would imagine. Very, very over. Again, they headlined several times, you know, and not like once or twice, but many times around the loop, either headlining or semi-main eventing. And in the AWA, semi-main eventing oftentimes meant you were the real main event because the way they booked, if you were second or even sometimes third from the top, you might have actually had the hottest storyline. And I've seen people say before where I'm exaggerating that when I was doing my Blackwell stuff. Okay, if I'm exaggerating that, then Hulk Hogan and Nick Bockwinkel were not the main event at the Super Sunday show that drew, you know, 25,000, 26,000 and set records in St. Paul. Because the actual main event of that show, the match that went on last, was Jerry Blackwell and Adnan versus Mad Dog Vachon and Vern Gagne. Now, does anybody really believe Hogan versus Bockwinkel wasn't basically a co-main event? Does anybody really? But no, of course not. You know, you could say that about multiple shows in the AWA. They, you know, in certain towns, you can point to a guy as a draw. I mean, the Crusher was clearly huge in Milwaukee. Okay, no question about it. But by and large, this was a territory where multiple you could have two or three matches on a show that you could point to as maybe being the reason that people were sitting there. You know, so you know, the second partner was Ventura, and then. They did also during 83, and I'm jumping around a lot, but this can all be bundled together in a lot of ways because he served the same role for most of this time. In 83, he wrestled in Memphis. He was brought in, I'm pretty sure, as part of the Andy Kaufman storyline originally with Lawler, and he had he won the CWA international title, you know, and feuded with Lawler for a big part of the year on and off in Memphis, and they did some really good houses in the Mid-South Coliseum during that period as well. So, you know, he's still in St. Louis. Now he's in Memphis too. You know, he was really all over the place during this period as well. It wasn't like, he stopped jet-setting around. And I think the Memphis run, which I haven't really seen, I've seen bits and pieces of clips, but I think the Memphis run is really interesting too, because I'm not going to sit here and suggest that Ken Patera was a big draw in Memphis, because I don't really believe that. But I think he was a credible challenger for Lawler and a different kind of challenger. And if you look at the attendance figures, which from Memphis are fairly complete, he didn't do insanely great business. But business picked up when he was around, and after he left, it really plummeted. And I think that was probably because Patera was sort of a novelty. He was something different in Memphis. It wasn't another Dundee Lawler, which, I mean, I love those guys. I think their matches are great. Don't get me wrong. But it was something outside of the norm and a little bit different. So I think he probably did help attendance a little bit there. And that was kind of his...
And an established name, too.
Yes. Absolutely. And really, that run versus – the run versus Lawler was really his last run as a single star of any real importance. I mean, he would have other runs where he would have singles matches, you know, during the AWA where he would headline on shows, or have important matches on shows in a singles capacity. And then in the WWF, a couple years down the road, he would actually
have several. You'd see him against Andre again, some. But really, his last run where he was identifiable as a singles talent was that 83 run in Memphis. After that, that was kind of the end of it. And then when he finished up in Memphis, he came back, and then shortly after the end of his run versus Lawler was when the Sheik started, which is really, that's another thing I should put in the thread, because that's another one of the great angles ever.
Well, and I think it's pretty safe to say that the Sheiks versus the High Flyers with Patera and Blackwell is probably your favorite stuff you've seen from the AWA, right?
Well,
overall.
Let me put it this way, okay? It is not necessarily the best matches I've seen. It is not necessarily the best storylines I've seen. But what it is it is the most surprising thing that has come out of the footage to me. There are better tag matches from the AWA. I mean, Buddy Rose and Doug Summers versus the Midnight Rockers, in my view, is one of the great tag team feuds in the history of the United States. There are other singles matches, Hennig versus Bockwinkel, things like that. But the Sheiks versus the Flyers, and really the Sheiks in general as an act, are one of the biggest and most entertaining surprises from the AWA set, from going through this footage that I'm going through, because I was not expecting to find that stuff entertaining. It wasn't on my radar coming in. And, the angle that sets it up is really great. Basically, Bobby Heenan, who was Ken Patera's manager, sells the rights to Ken Patera to Adnan LKC, who actually Adnan actually proposes the deal. He solicits the deal, and they do the whole thing where Heenan brings a briefcase of money, and they seal the transaction on the set. And it was just such a great angle, because here you have the evil Arab oil sheik who has now purchased – he's already got this, salt-of-the-earth redneck Jerry Blackwell, who he's been teaming with for a year at this point, and is huge heel, and both literally and figuratively. And he brings in his tag team partner an American Olympian who's basically turned his back on his country, for money and prestige. And it really is a great, great angle, the way it was executed on TV with Gene Okerlund freaking out about it the whole time. And,
well, that's a real predecessor to Heenan selling Andre to DiBiase, too, right?
Yeah, it is. It absolutely is. It's kind of the same principle in a lot of ways. And it really was a hot feud. I mean, the Sheiks, it's weird. The Sheiks as an overall act, I think, drew more than the Sheiks as the twosome of Patera and Blackwell. I think you have to throw Adnan into the equation and look at all three of them. And if you look at all three of them, they were really a huge draw. And in fact, when Blackwell would subsequently turn babyface, that was one of the last, even then, Blackwell versus whoever Adnan's chosen opponent was, whether it be Bruiser Brody or Mass Superstar, even himself, was actually one of the last feuds that really drew in the AWA at all.
Did Blackwell feud against Patera at all?
Blackwell did not feud against Patera, because by that point Patera had left. That's right. And I don't know all the details about it. I'll get up to speed right now on that, actually. The Sheiks, basically, as a unit, those three guys, I almost said the threesome for our extra porn joke of the night, but those three guys headlined and did really big business for about almost exactly a year, all over the territory, and a variety of capacities. Really, Adnan and Blackwell have been headlining as a tag team even before that. So if you want to go farther back, this was basically a two-year run where some version of this unit was
two-year
a big deal.
Run, yeah.
Patera and Blackwell, who also feuded briefly and tag team briefly in St. Louis slightly before this too, the Sheiks were actually, the AWA tag team titles didn't get farmed out a lot. They did some shows in Hawaii during that earlier period we talked about in the 70s, but usually it was only the world title that got farmed out a lot, because the tag team titles were relied on at home to be a draw. But I think one of the testaments to how good the Sheiks were as a unit is that they actually did farm them out. And they worked in St. Louis. They worked in Montreal against your boy Leo Burke.
Yeah.
And
Rick Martel, yeah.
Yep. And that was a main event too. And they worked in Memphis. In fact, the Sheiks had a couple matches in Memphis defending the AWA titles, one of which was versus the Rock and Roll Express. I don't think it exists on tape, and I hate life for the fact that it does not exist on tape, because I really want to see that
match.
Yeah,
that's definitely some kind of conspiracy is involved in that not being on tape.
Yeah, I want to say on that same show, the Moondogs versus the Fabulous Ones is the main event, and that's second from the top. So you got your tag team double main event there. Both of those matches on paper sound great. But, so the Sheiks, they were actually farmed out to other territories, which I think indicates that they were a pretty strong team. They drew some huge houses. You know, as an overall act, they did huge houses in St. Paul, one of the last massive houses there, like 19,000 for a cage match. Technically that was Adnan and Blackwell, but Patera was at ringside. It was the overall presentation of the act is really what matters. They did some huge, huge, huge numbers. They did really big numbers in Green Bay. Really big numbers in Milwaukee, just numbers all around the loop, and they had really good matches, too. They had really good tag team dynamic. One of those tag teams you wish had stayed around longer. They were really good dynamic. As both guys were just really good bumping heels and just easily hateable in their roles at the time. But what happened is, May or April of 84. I guess it was May of 84. I'm trying to remember when. I think it might have been April of 84. Saito and Patera pulled through the window of McDonald's. And
but hadn't he gone back to WWF for a while? He was there and did
the time period.
Well, but he was there
time,
when he did this.
My impression.
He did the story. He did the storyline where he and John Studd cut Andre's hair, right?
That is at the end of 84. What happens is, this is really weird, because what happens is, and that's really his last major run, is that run there, which we're about to get to. What happens is him and Saito throw a boulder through a McDonald's window because they're denied service, even though the restaurant was closed. And Patera, at that point, I think wrestles for about a month longer in the AWA. He then goes, this part fascinates me. Here's a guy who's committed pretty much a major crime, or at least is accused of committing a major crime at this point. He hadn't been convicted. And he then goes on to New Japan.
he was only a stone's throw away from being convicted, though.
Oh, man, that's awesome.
That's what I've been sitting on for a while.
He then goes to New Japan, which I think is insane. I mean, here's a guy who's like a major crime charged against
him.
Yeah,
he goes overseas.
And he flees the country, almost immediately, within a couple months. And he has a long run in New Japan. He's part of a New Japan tournament. He wrestles pretty much every big guy there. He'd been to New Japan at least once before. So there's yet another place where he's wrestled all these top guys, although I don't think he was really presented as a top gaijin. The point is he's in the mix with, your Inokis and Fujinamis and people like that.
A regular there as much as an occasional tourer.
That's correct. And then he comes back, and he's in the WWF. And that's when they do the angle where, he's effectively reunited with Heenan in the WWF, for all intents and purposes. And they do the angle with Big John Studd, and they cut Andre's hair. And that is the last great run of Ken Patera's career. And, it starts in late 84, and it runs through 85 up until he goes to jail, which I guess was it May or June? I can't remember exactly when it was, but it basically runs up to that point. It cooled off a lot in March. And it wasn't as common around the horn for the last month and a half, but they were still getting mileage out of it. In fact, some of his last couple matches in the promotion were versus Hogan, were title matches versus Hogan. He had one in Philadelphia, which did not do good business. Only did 5,000 at the Spectrum, which is really piss poor for a Hogan era match. He did one in Miami that didn't do very well at all, did about half capacity, but Florida was a tough place for Vince to break into at that point. And he did one in Denver that actually did do very well. The Denver match, I think, did 9,000. So that was a good, but Denver was an old AWA stop. So that
would be the classic example of Vince raiding the towns of the other territories.
Oh yeah, and if you look at the beginning run of some of Patera's dates with the WWF, I mean, they put him up against, he'd have matches where he, you know, like Mad Dog Vachon was the referee, or, you know, they knew what they were doing in those towns. But you know, that Andre feud was a good feud, you know, because basically what it was Andre and friends versus Patera and Stud. And Patera was clearly number two. Stud was clearly the guy that was presented as the bigger deal of the two, but Patera was an integral part of it, and Patera had a lot of matches with Andre, singles matches during that period. Those were mainly on the B show.
And they were both the heels that cut. They were both presented equally as the heels that cut his hair.
Yes.
And that's a big deal because, I mean, Andre had always had the big fro his entire career, and then he goes down to that. So.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was a big angle. It was a really big angle, and it did good business around the horn. It really did. I mean, they ran it in every major marquee you can think of. And lots of times it main evented with no Hogan. What they did not pair that up with Hogan a lot. That was – you know, Hogan would hit one town, and that feud would hit the other town. And some people say, well, that's a B show. Well, if you look at the arenas they were running, not really. You know, they were running that feud in L.A., in Oakland, in Boston, in Pittsburgh. I mean, they ran that feud in the big buildings. It's not like they were running that feud in Salisbury, Maryland. at the YMCA. They were running that in the big buildings and the big markets and that venue and doing big money off of it. It was a very successful feud. It did run out of steam eventually, but it did good business all over the place. It everywhere it went, it did pretty well. It was a cool note for Patera to go out on, the fact that, you know, Hogan was his last real matches, and that his last real feud of note was versus Andre, I think is kind of a cool little quirk. But it definitely was a really hot storyline. And like I said, it was Andre and friends. They kind of subbed out whoever Andre's partner was. Lots of times it was Junkyard Dog, but they kind of rotated in various people over the course of that run to get his Andre's partner to feud with or to wrestle Patera and Stud on these shows. But definitely a good final run for Patera. And I think, you know, as you look at the Spectrum, there's a guy who basically debuted in 73, technically at the end of 72. And now we hit 85, in the middle of 85 when he goes to prison. At no point during this entire run is he anything other than an upper mid-carder. He's either an upper mid-carder or a main eventer for this entire period. If you look at this entire period, he main evented in the following buildings: Madison Square Garden, the Boston Garden, the Philadelphia Spectrum, the Greensboro Coliseum, the Omni in Atlanta, the St. Paul Civic Center, the Kiel Auditorium in St. Louis, the Montreal Forum, the Maple Leaf Gardens in Toronto. I mean, basically every single major building you could have main evented in as a wrestler during that
probably
time
Houston
period.
Coliseum.
What's that?
Houston, too?
He worked in Houston. I don't think he ever quite was in the main event, but even in the semi main there. But you know, but then again, I don't have all the results from Houston, so that actually is possible. But if you look at this across the board, he main evented basically in every major building you could possibly have main evented in as a wrestling star during that era. And he did them all more than once. And on top of it, if you look at the guys he feuded with or had programs with, Wahoo McDaniel, Tony Atlas, Bruno Sammartino, Pedro Morales, Bob Backlund, Hulk Hogan, Andre the Giant, Dusty Rhodes,
it literally Tommy Rich in 1981, which was a huge deal. It was a who's who of guys that were stars.
McDonald.
the American legal system. It was literally a who's who. So I think it's important to think about that. How many guys can say they main evented that many places more than once, and that they main evented against those guys more than once? I mean, that's a very,
yeah.
very, very small group. That doesn't even get into the various guys he challenged for the NWA title. It doesn't even get into his run with various tag teams, you know, whether it be teaming the Stud or with Blackwell or Bobby Duncan or Ventura. I neglected Memphis. I mean, we just talked about
or
how
even
that.
The little bit of Japan work he did.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't even touch that stuff. I mean, if you really get into it with Patera, you see a guy, you know, that sort of offhand comment that sort of partially touched this off for me to do all this stuff. Patera was a huge star in wrestling. You could eat, and honestly,
yeah.
if his career had closed out differently, I think people would remember him as a Ted DiBiase-type guy who was, you know, I mean, DiBiase, to be fair, did anchor in Mid-South and stuff, but as one of these guys who was a hugely successful heel that maybe never held the NWA title but is sort of synonymous with an era of wrestling as a heel. And DiBiase
yeah.
is a great babyface, too, to his credit. But,
the stuff he did, too, in 87 when he came back, I mean, that was a pretty big focal point to TV, is Feud with the Heenan
family. That is actually really interesting, because I talked to a couple people the other day, and actually somebody on Wrestling Classics started a thread after I talked to a couple people about this, so this was kind of interesting. And I'll post this podcast up there, too, for people to take a look at. But somebody had, made the point that Patera, had he been brought back as a heel, probably would have been much better off than the attempt to bring him back as a babyface. Because actually in 87, when they brought him back, he was put in a position to draw again on the B shows as
yeah.
the guy, you know, who was the Heenan family foil. The problem was it didn't draw. It was the first time that Patera had been put in a position to draw in his entire career where it just didn't work. I mean, he did some good shows in that top slot, or maybe that second from the top slot, but nowhere near what I think they were expecting. And, you know, the angle with him and Heenan on TV and him breaking Heenan's neck was, I think, kind of uncomfortable for some people. It's very memorable to me as a kid. But, it wasn't a totally dead in the water storyline, but it did not work nearly to the degree they wanted it to. And I actually saw somebody who said the other day that one of the original plans, I can't remember who it was. I wish I remember who this was, but I think it was at Classics, Wrestling Classics.
Probably when you were talking with Vince McMahon.
I'm sure it was probably Vince or Hogan.
Yeah.
But so somebody who said that actually one of the original ideas that was batted around was Patera versus Hogan headlining at WrestleMania, four or five, after he got out of prison after a big buildup through all this stuff. Now, I don't know how true that is. That could be another
yeah.
thing like the NWA title claim. But that
well,
wouldn't
it
totally
might have been
shock me.
Of for, oh, no, hey, wait, yeah.
That would not totally shock me, because if they had positioned if the idea was to position him as a draw originally, which it clearly was, it's theoretically possible that they may have had more long term plans, because back then they did plan a lot longer than they do now, where they do everything off the cuff. So it's theoretically possible that that was a long term goal of theirs that never came off because Patera just didn't work out in that run.
Yeah, and then from. Finished out jobbing out. Like, I know he lost to Bad News Brown at SummerSlam 88, and then ended up pretty much going to AWA from there and having the tag team title run with Brad Rangins, where they won it from
yep.
Bad Company, right?
Yep. I mean, basically,
his
last little stint in the business was, you know, the feud with the Heenan family that didn't work out. Then they put him in a short-lived tag team with Billy Jack Haynes, the feud with Demolition around the horn. you know, mostly on B or C, even C shows.
Yeah.
You know, and then after he finished up with the Billy Jack team, they really, it's unfortunate the way his career ended up, because he really, his last period in the WWF really sucked for him, because, you know, losing to Bad News, that's not that big a deal. Bad News was pretty well pushed, but his last few TV matches were jobbing to Ron Bass and the Red Rooster. So, you know,
I do find it interesting. It's an interesting comment on race relations, though, that at 1988, when he was when he had the SummerSlam match with Bad News Brown, he's pushed as the Olympian when he didn't place in weightlifting, and medal is Bad News Brown.
For the Browns,
pushed
the Street
medal. Fighter again.
That actually is,
yeah,
is pretty amusing. I didn't even think about that. The yeah, that's a good one. But his losing to Red Rooster and possibly his last televised match probably sucked. But again, it's worth noting. Actually, his last televised match, I guess, would have been Survivor Series 88, because he was in the 10-man tag. I think Rude is the guy who pinned him. But you know,
that's really how careers and tenures end. Sure, right?
Well, but
you know what though?
Here's the thing. What's notable about Patera is, and you're right, he did go on to the AWA and win the tag belts and have a very brief run there. You know, it's kind of the strong
and
winning the car lifting competition versus the Destruction Crew and stuff like that, which is kind of a cool angle in Rochester. But
and Herb Abrams reviewed WF of it as well, eh?
Yeah. He did a little bit
Kirby
of UWF.
UWF too, yeah.
But what's interesting about Patera is, as opposed to a lot of these other guys who were big stars, somebody like a Greg Valentine, who in some ways is comparable, actually, to Patera, they kind of, you know, I don't want to say, like, I don't want to criticize anybody for sticking around too long, just because if that's what you know and that's how you've made your money and had your career, who the hell am I to tell you that you can't do that? But
especially when you're coming out of jail. But
Patera really only had a very brief period of as a enhancement talent, so to speak. I mean, if you look at his whole career, he basically had a brief period of 1988, maybe late 87 too. I'd have to go back and look, where he was, you know, a true lower rung wrestler. For the entire rest of his career, he was either a main eventer or a semi-main event to upper mid-card guy. When you really think about that, and you think about how many other major stars did not have endings that were, that had long, protracted endings where they were, you know, stuck, like, in the opening match of Nitro, like your Greg Valentine's,
yeah.
Or even like Bob Backlund, who did have that really good run in 94, but sort of became a caricature of himself in a weird way after that. I think it's kind of cool that Patera, even though he's, you know, in some ways the guy you would think would have the hardest fall given his prison sentence, in some ways he has a relatively modest fall from grace by comparison to these other guys. I mean, he really did not have a long run as a low totem pole guy at all. Very, very brief period of time. When you stack it up next to the huge length of time when he was, you know, a big deal, especially because he didn't really, he wasn't eased in. He was pretty much right away an upper mid-card talent. It's pretty striking. The whole scope of his career is overwhelmingly positive by comparison to even a lot of people who people just sort of reflexively assume were bigger deals. So it's, you know, I mean, to me, I mean, even somebody like, you know, take Kurt Hennig, same thing. You know, Kurt Hennig, we remember fondly as Mr. Perfect. Mr. Perfect couldn't even draw against Hulk Hogan. He was a great wrestler in the ring, you know, especially in Portland in the AWA. But in terms of the broad scope of his career, Ken Patera had a far better career than Kurt Hennig, and a much, much less striking ending run, too, I think. But that's just me.
Yeah. And if you want to look at long-term impact on his legacy, you know, his wrestling footprint, as we shall call it, you can now search Ken Patera on YouTube and find a link. For someone has made a little video of an ad for Hungry Hungry Hippo, except every time the word hippo is said, they say Ken Patera and put a picture of him over the hippo. And you can Google Hungry Hungry Ken Patera. And that really shows what a successful career he had.
You're
getting some head shaking here.
You totally undermined my substantially even my much crappier joke. No, my much crappier joke, which was going to be that, you know, another part of my motivation was to maybe get Ken Patera back on the ballot for the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, because I think he's a guy with a very, very formidable career if you look at it. But you know, I was going to make the joke that since we're allowed to count UFC careers as part of UFC, Ken Patera's success in the World's Strongest Man competition and being a guy who still occasionally appears on ESPN reruns should work in his favor as well.
Yeah, no, I think that's overshadowed by Hungry Hungry Ken Patera for sure. Okay, we should wrap it up, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know what time it is.
Yeah, we've been yakking for about 2 hours now. So.
Okay, well, I'm going to
our next show is food.
But anyway, go ahead.
I was just going to say that we've got a possibility of a guest for our next show. It's not our next show. We'll probably have him on sometime in the future. But until it actually happens, I'd rather not say it ahead of time. But great doing the show tonight.
Great as always.
Ken Patera is awesome.
Ken Patera is awesome. And next time I talk to you either, I'm sure I'll talk to you this week. But, you know, at the end of this week I'm going to that SmackDown house show, which is right just a couple days after Daniel Bryan versus Mark Henry cage match on the live show on Tuesday. So I'll give you an update on that, and maybe the next time we do a show I might touch a little bit on that if we don't have the guest we're hoping to have.
Yeah. Well, that's assuming you're entertained after throwing a rock through a Burger King window.
That's right.
I don't want to be a total poser.
So I do maybe I'll do Taco Bell. But all right. I'll talk to you later, Dave.
Or Subway, because you can have a veggie sub. Anyway, I'll let you go, and great talking to you again.
Good talking to you too. Bye.
Bye.